At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate profits are high. Workers' wages are stuck. You add them up and the answer could be a new stock market bubble. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, everybody, the 24th of May. Glad, as always, to have you with us. As a whole, American banks are doing all right. They're doing pretty well, actually. So said the FDIC this morning. Outgoing Chairwoman Sheila Bair announced banking's collective quarterly earnings were up 66% the first 3 months of this year. There are some caveats, as there usually are. Profits were concentrated in the very biggest of the big institutions, and banks are still failing at a higher rate than one would like. But for now, at least, corporate profits, like the ones that the banks are enjoying, are helping to keep the stock market higher than it might deserve to be. Bubble is a strong word, I know, but Jack Howe writes in Smart Money magazine that maybe we're looking at the wrong indicators as we judge where the market ought to be. Jack, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
We have this thing we look at when we talk about stock prices. It's called price-to-earnings ratio, the stock price as compared to a year's worth of a given company's earnings. You suggest in this piece in Smart Money that maybe P.E. ratios, as they're known, aren't really the right measure. So what should we be looking at?
Well, they might mislead right now. Stock investors know what a P.E. ratio is. If you're not a stock investor, you're not familiar with them, don't worry. But just know that historically, the average stock in America has traded at about 15 times earnings, maybe just a touch less than that. And right now, the stock market as a whole is about 15 times earnings. So on the surface, it seems like there's not much to worry about with stock prices. But you know, in my piece, I basically wrote about you have to look at earnings, corporate earnings, as a share of the economy. What you find right now is that corporations are so far into record territory with the size of their earnings relative to the size of the economy that in the past, that has signaled a decline in earnings waiting to happen. And that could bring stock prices down.
Is it some function of corporations making so much more money than they have in the past and workers, that is to say wages, not being as big a chunk as they have in the past? Because as we know, wages have been stuck.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. When you look at, you know, the trend of the past decade, companies making a lot more money overseas, that's great for their profits. But what's happening to America's workers? Well, you know, we've lost jobs and the new jobs that we're finding don't have such great wages. So keep in mind the workers are also shoppers. Corporations need workers to make decent money so they can continue to buy their products in the U.S. And I think that's why there has been this relatively constant relationship. You know, corporations are always struggling with workers for who gets a bigger slice of the economic pie. But when one wins out too well, mm-hmm. that's usually temporary.
Give me a sense of how out of whack versus the historical mean corporate earnings are as a share of the economy.
Well, the historic average is 6.4%. And we had some high periods in the past that were in the 8% to 9% range.
That is as a percent of national income, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And those periods were always followed by a sharp decline in earnings. Right now, we're between 9 and 10%. There's only 2 points in history when we were this high before. One is 2006. That's just at the peak of the housing bubble, just before the recent financial crisis. The other was in 1929, just before the stock crash that kicked off the Great Depression.
So is there a chance? I mean, we've all talked about how the economy has changed and we have conceivably a new normal. Could it be that corporate profits are just going to be this high and we're going to have to get used to this?
You know, one explanation is that, as I said, companies are making more money overseas. So if we believe that emerging markets are going to boom forever, maybe we'll be okay. But I'm always suspicious of arguments like that that say that the rules have changed. I think that a more likely scenario is that earnings are going to come down. And if they do, I think as a stock investor, you just want to be a little cautious right now. It's not like you want to dump everything and run for the hills, but you want to start thinking safe, start, you know, maybe raising a little cash, start buying safer stocks than you otherwise would.
Jack Howe, columnist for Smart Money Magazine. Jack, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, up a little, down a little. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We interrupt this broadcast with another dose of very unpleasant economic medicine for the good people of Greece. There's been news this week of more deep cuts in public spending, as well as an accelerated plan to sell off state property to raise some much-needed cash. But what's being called the sale of the century is winning the government no new friends, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk.
The assets range from shares in the country's main telecom operator, a major savings bank, two of the biggest ports, and the publicly owned power generation company. An extraordinary haul, says commentator John Serapolis.
This is all among the prime, not only real estate assets of the public sector, but also business interests of the public sector. So they really are putting out the family silver.
And hoping to raise some $70 billion in the process to pay off some of the national debt. But the worry, says Martina Stevis of the Eleftherotypia newspaper, is that the sales won't raise anything like that sum.
The question really is, how will the Greek government be able to effectively negotiate good prices for these assets while the potential buyers know that the Greek government is desperate for cash?
Martina says the Greek people feel humiliated and are beginning to blame the rest of the Eurozone for their plight. They'd even prefer to see their national assets sold to the Chinese rather than their European partners.
The prospect of these assets being owned by investors who have not participated in this shaming just feels more appealing. I personally don't share these emotions, but I know that some of my compatriots do.
The asset sales are a last-ditch attempt to prevent a default, although politicians now tend to avoid that word. The talk is of rearranging, restructuring or reprofiling Greece's debt. Whatever you call it, and in spite of the asset sales, that is beginning to look more likely. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Used to be you had your discount stores and you had your upscale stores and never the twain did meet. The last couple of years, though, pretty much since the recession, shoppers don't really care what status the store comes with. They just want the best deal they can get, online, high-end, or discount. You take your pick. And maybe that's why the full-price department store Macy's has decided to open a new store outside Chicago in what is traditionally considered an outlet mall. Marketplace's Janet Babin has the story.
Gurney Mills Mall is a place to buy upscale leftovers at last-chance prices. Now, Macy's runs lots of sales, but it's no discount store. And Macy's Jim Slezewski says the company doesn't intend to become one either. He says the outlet center offered Macy's an opportunity.
For us, this was a piece of the Chicago metro area where we had a gap in our store coverage.
But the real gap may be between what consumers expect and what full-price stores can offer, especially with so many choices available online and through mobile devices. Michael Dartz, a retail strategist at Kurt Salmon, he says consumers want one-stop shopping.
The store used to be at the center. Now the consumer is in the center, and you have to go to where the consumer is, and you can't expect the consumer just to automatically come to where you are.
And since the recession, consumers can increasingly be found at discount stores and malls and online, lured by flash sales, those deeply discounted exclusives that last only a few hours. Christina Norsig of Pop-Up Insider says Macy's is looking for a way to keep up.
Times are changing. They have to find their place. I still think it's a dangerous move for someone like Macy's to do that. It could hurt the brand image.
But with fashion becoming so price competitive, that's a risk Macy's is willing to take. The new store opens in the spring of 2013. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Let's say you're visiting Los Angeles and you're having dinner at one of those celebrity hangouts and some well-known starlet fresh from rehab just happens to go past you on the way to the ladies' room. You grab your phone, you snap a picture, you upload it to Twitter with an app called TwitPic. That way you can share your paparazzi moment with your friends and then maybe pay for the trip by selling the shot to gossip sites like TMZ for thousands of dollars. Which sounds great, except for that last part. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains that even though you took the picture, you don't own the rights to it anymore.
A celebrity photo agency called World Entertainment News Network now has the exclusive right to license and sell photos Twitter users post to their own accounts using the app TwitPic. Molly Wood is executive editor at technology website CNET. She says this is just the beginning.
Now, these news and photo agencies are coming along and saying, we're going to take control of the rights to these photos, make money off of them, and sue you or other people if they try to use them.
This photographic land grab is included in the terms of service. It's all that small print legalese most of us just scroll through, then click agree.
You have very few rights when it comes to terms of service, and the fact is they almost all have boilerplate language around being granted some sort of license to your photos.
There's already a backlash. Ellen DeGeneres, who has millions of followers on Twitter, announced she won't post pictures using TwitPic anymore. Technology analyst Carl Howe at the Yankee Group says this isn't just about celebrities.
Recently, Stephanie Gordon took a picture of the space shuttle launching.
No reason you should know who Stephanie Gordon is. She's not rich or famous. She just happened to be on an airplane above the shuttle as it burst through the clouds, pulled out her phone, snapped, and uploaded to TwitPic.
And that photo was shown on all the major broadcast networks.
But if she ever wants to sell the images, let's say for a Great Moments in Shuttle History coffee table book, well, she better have a good lawyer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, forget fantasy sports, fantasy investing, baby.
I made some money on Ford because I shorted Ford, and Ford isn't performing so well today.
But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. Another day, more worries about the European debt crisis. The Dow Industrial slipped 25 points, about 0.2%, closed at 12,356. The NASDAQ dumped 12 points, 0.4%, to 2746 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost a point, less than 0.1%, finished at 1316. Shares of medical device maker Medtronic dipped nearly 1% today after quarterly earnings fell short of expectations. Investors clipped Boeing's wings by nearly 1% even after the company predicted its replacement for the popular 737 would be more fuel efficient. On the positive side, the IPO for the Russian search engine Yandex generated a lot of hits. Shares gained more than 55% today. Bond prices were higher. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.11%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. You'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing.
I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at AllyBank.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for April. The House Homeland Security Committee discusses the security implications of killing Osama bin Laden. And at the National Press Club, advocacy group Oceana launches a campaign to stop seafood fraud. Organizers say some varieties of fish may be mislabeled 25 to 70% of the time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. And here we are, almost at the day. After 18 months of buildup, a final visit from Tom Cruise and one last car giveaway, Oprah is taking herself off the air tomorrow. After 25 seasons, she transcends mere celebrity. She's an instant tastemaker, the world's richest entertainer, and a brand unto herself, which is why, paradoxically, this farewell moment isn't just all about Oprah. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich has more.
If Oprah had wanted to stretch things out another year, she could have. If she wanted to go another 100 years, scientists would have found a way. But the end is here, and it is epic. Fans are emoting on YouTube.
You have been so much to me, and I want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
But with an event this big, regular Oprah fans are just the tip of the iceberg. Here's Adam Armbruster, television and retail consultant.
It also creates water cooler conversation audience. I call it halo audience. It's people that normally wouldn't watch her, and they just get sucked into the hype. And there's massive hype going on right now. You try to watch any show tonight, any entertainment program. It's all over it.
Oprah taping two of her final shows yesterday.
Oprah's goodbye is so big, they couldn't do it at her studio. Continue with day two of our Oprah quiz.
Entertainment Tonight and its offspring have been feeding off the Oprah countdown for weeks. But Armbruster says network and local newscasts are also hitting it hard to pull in viewers during the critical end of May period when audience numbers are measured. Then there are the companies hoping for an economic bounce if they can share in the glow. The cost for a 30-second ad on the finale is unheard of for daytime TV. Here's how Oprah might deliver the news.
$1 million.
What?
I know. For comparison, ads on the last Super Bowl were $3 million. Dori Molitor runs a marketing consultancy called WomanWise. She says advertising on Oprah's final show is valuable beyond just the raw viewer numbers.
Quite frankly, I think that's secondary to the main reason they want to be there. I can't think of another environment that would be more uplifting, more positive. Putting their brand there, brands are hoping to have a halo effect.
There's that halo again. As St. Oprah ascends to her next plane of existence, who can fill the economic void left by her show? Adam Armbruster says some industries, like publishing, are significantly Oprah-powered.
She can hold a book up to the screen and it becomes a bestseller. Tell me who else has the power to do that.
Dr. Oz, Ellen, Katie Couric, Oprah has declined to bestow her halo, or her time slot, on any one successor. And the TV audience has splintered during Oprah's 25-year reign. It'll be more difficult to amass her kind of power to sway industries. Partly, the void left by the Oprah show will be filled by Oprah. As she attends more to her struggling TV network, she'll be working levers behind the curtain to keep that significant Oprah-fied economy within her orbit. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
It's pretty rare to have a conversation about education policy in which the word technology isn't used at some point. Occasionally in the administrative sense as a way to make education more efficient, but mostly in the classroom sense, helping kids learn. Which gets us to Salman Khan. He's a former hedge fund manager turned educator as the founder and sole faculty member of the Khan Academy. It started as a tutoring service for his cousins on YouTube. It's become a library of thousands of instructional videos on topics from basic arithmetic to organic chemistry to the French Revolution, with financial backing from, among others, the Gates Foundation. Sal Khan, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
How exactly did you wind up putting videos on YouTube?
I was a little dismissive of it at first. I didn't think YouTube was for serious mathematics. I thought it was more for dogs on skateboards or whatever else. But I decided to give it a shot, and people all over the world started watching them. And, you know, some of them would say, hey, this helped me on an exam. But someone would say, hey, this helped me not drop out of high school, or this helped me get into the school that I wanted to get into. So it became a pretty exciting thing to work on.
What's the education problem, though, that you think this technology can solve?
It's a pretty straightforward problem is that everyone learns at different paces, and right now everyone's forced to go at the same pace. And it's a more serious problem than just people being bored or people being lost in one classroom. What happens when everyone moves at the same pace is you and I are in an exam, or, you know, we're learning a basic subject. I don't get 5% of the subject. You don't get 20% of the subject. The whole class moves on to a more advanced subject. I have a 5% gap. You have a 20% gap. Those gaps build up over time, and it pretty much guarantees that most students, by the time they get to algebra or calculus, have so many of these gaps that no matter how hard they try, they just can't understand what's going on. So what we're trying to address is every student can go at their own pace, make sure that they master something before moving on, and when you do that, then those gaps shouldn't happen.
It's an accumulation of failure, right? Isn't that your phrase?
Yeah, I would say it's an accumulation of gaps. And actually, the failure thing is another interesting. You know, right now, when you take an assessment, a test in school, you get a label. You get an A, B, or C, or D. You know, the A kids kind of feel good about themselves. They get self-confidence. B students are a little bit neutral. You get a C, D, or F. It's not viewed as, hey, you didn't understand 30%. Why don't you go and try to learn it a little bit better? It's viewed as, you're not so smart. Don't try to become an engineer or a physicist.
Where do you fit in, though? Where does the Khan Academy fit in the larger application of technology to education? How do you slide in there?
For a while, whenever people talk about technology and education, they've just been talking about putting computers or iPads or whatever in a room and hoping something good happens. Even when there was something to do on a computer, it was always viewed as separate from the core curriculum. It was viewed separate of what normally goes on in a math class. What we're saying is now we can actually use technology, we can use these videos, we can use this software to allow every student to work at their own pace. It's not an either-or proposition anymore. But there's always this debate of, do you do more of the core skills or do more of the projects and the investigations? We're saying you can do both. You can use the technology to handle a lot of the core skills, free up a lot of the teacher's time to do more of the human interactions.
For the price of a login, right, you either log in through Facebook or Google, you get access to all these things. Is there a thought in your mind of somehow making people pay for this?
We want to, at some point, be sustainable as a not-for-profit, but we want all of this material to be 100% accessible by everyone. So on the web and our core tools will always be free. Right now, nothing on our radar is non-free, I guess is the simple answer.
So what's the next step for the Khan Academy?
Right now, we have about 2 million students a month who use our site on a regular basis. We want to start leveraging them so that they can help each other. So if you're in a classroom, your teacher knows that you need help. But if you're not in a classroom, or if you need a supplement to a classroom, maybe one of the other community members of the Khan Academy can tutor you or help you out or get you past your hurdle.
Salman Khan, he's the founder of the Khan Academy. Thanks a lot.
Great, thanks.
There are more ways than you can count to find out what's going on in the stock market. But unless you've got money on the line, what happens on Wall Street every day can be somewhat abstract. Catch is that putting on the money on the line means having money on the line and maybe losing it, which is where we enter UpDown.com. It's kind of like a fantasy sports league. You pick your team, investments in this case, you see how it does, and you sit back. And you might be able to make a little money if you're smart, or if you're lucky. Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
In the summer of 2006, a Harvard Business School student from Germany named Michael Reich was hanging out in his dorm room. He'd been enrolled only 2 weeks, and just like that, he had an idea for a new company.
Yeah, and I was actually sitting at my desk reading stock market news and at the same time having my Facebook account open. And that's when I thought, hey, how could you marry this concept of social networking with investing?
You put your chocolate in my peanut butter.
That's right.
About a year later, with a couple of classmates and some seed money from an investor, he launched UpDown.com, And now the site has 400,000 members and makes its money from advertising. It looks pretty much like any investment site. There's a graph of how the markets are doing, some news headlines, and if you open an account, UpDown gives you $1 million virtual dollars to pretend invest. Then it tracks how much you would have made or lost if you had actually invested.
So this is me today. I gained 0.1% in my portfolio. I made some money on Ford because I shorted Ford, and it seems that that Ford isn't performing so well today.
You can also link with other users on the site, a la Facebook, and gauge your performance against theirs.
Yeah, so we see here that I'm definitely not the best. Zachary seems to be doing the best among my friends, up 18% since start.
Damn you, Zachary.
But the most interesting thing about UpDown is that it pays its best performing users every month. The number one virtual earner gets 500 real dollars. The second best gets 250. The third gets 100 bucks. In fact, anybody whose portfolio ends up higher percentage-wise than the market average that month gets a little money.
I think we pay out 1 cent to everyone who beats the market.
That seems like more trouble than it's worth, my friend.
Yeah, we only allow people to get a payout once they've reached, I don't know, 50 cents or a dollar. So it's more a token of, hey, you know, we value that you played in the contest and that you beat the market.
For instance, Eric Kahan, an UpDown user here in New York, has so far earned,
I think, $11, but I don't even know how to get the money.
I asked him to show me his portfolio, and he's done pretty well.
So I'm up 39.4% since I started.
Which was 3 years ago. He's invested in the real market, too, but he uses UpDown mainly to take risks he doesn't dare take in the real world.
I'm less cautious, obviously. I'm willing to put $100,000 into something that I don't fully understand what they do.
Kahan's only criticism about the site is that it should pretend tax you on the money you pretend earn. That'd be more realistic, he says. But Stephen Figluski, who teaches futures and options at NYU, is a little skeptical about the contest element.
Up, down, like that, updown.com?
Mm-hmm.
We pulled up the site in his office. Overall, he says it looks like a good learning tool, but he says competing against other investors can teach bad habits that a novice might transfer into real life.
If we think, well, I'm in competition with 50 other people, and I've got to be the best out of 50, the way to do that is to find some wildly speculative stock and plunge as much as I possibly can, and then be lucky. That's a rational strategy. You swing for the fence and hope you hit a long home run, because that's the only way you can possibly win. That's not the way one should invest.
Michael Reich is aware of that worry and says UpDown tries to discourage that kind of behavior. For instance, it lets users put only $20,000 into any given stock. At the same time, he says, UpDown might be a good confidence booster for folks who are overly nervous about the real market.
So you're investing maybe too little or not aggressive enough because it's your real money and you're really scared about your money, whereas maybe that would be the right decision. Some people, it might be liberating and empowering to just trade and not worry about the money that they're losing.
I asked Reich if he's invested in the real market. He says he used to be, but not right now. He has to devote his extra money to paying off student loans. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, once again, an alcoholic beverage to wrap things up. I'm not sure what that says. But anyway, yesterday it was President Obama laying down a couple of pounds for a pint of Guinness in Ireland. Today it's the giant beverage conglomerate Diageo and tequila. Bloomberg News says the owner of Johnny Walker Scotch and Smirnoff Vodka and, yes, Guinness, is interested in buying Jose Cuervo. Price tag is $2 billion. Cuervo is family-owned, by the way, based on a grant from the Spanish king back in 1758. We haven't been around that long, but we've been here for a while. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 25 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ dropped 12 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, less than 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. And that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news come tomorrow morning. And next time back here, roll your own cigarette shops are the newest retro craze.
Our machine will make about 4 cartons in an hour. A true cigarette manufacturing machine will make upwards of 20,000 cigarettes a minute.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.